As we continue to navigate coronavirus and everything that goes along with it, it's easy to feel like things are out of our control. But there are little things we can do to help us feel like we're getting back some of that control, including helping our communities. Today, we'll check in with some of the local organizations that have been impacted by the coronavirus and find out different ways we can help. And we'll revisit an interview with actor and Illinois native Theo Germain, who plays James in the Netflix series, The Politician. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, and WNIJ in DeKalb. Stay tuned, the 21st comes up right after the news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Reginald Hardwick. As of this morning, the State Health Department says there are 1,049 people diagnosed with COVID-19. The cases range from an infant to a 99-year-old person. So far, there have been 9 deaths. This is the first Monday we've been under a stay-at-home order issued by Governor J.B. Pritzker. Schools have been ordered closed until April 7th. Hearing those numbers and trying to monitor this changing situation every day can make things feel out of our control. But there are little things we can do to help us feel like we're getting back some of that stability, and that can make us feel like we are making a difference in our communities. Today, we wanted to check in with some of the local organizations that have been impacted by the coronavirus and find out different ways we can help. Over the past few weeks, fewer donations coupled with more people in need has left food banks in a difficult position. And as people are told to stay home and maintain social distancing, less volunteers are able to help stock the shelves and hand out supplies. Feeding America estimates that more than 1.3 million people are struggling with hunger in Illinois, and more than 450,000 of those people are children. On the line with me now, Molly Delaney. She's Vice President of Development for the Eastern Illinois Food Bank. Also joining us is Food Bank President and CEO Jim Hires. Molly and Jim, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you.
Thank you, Reginald. Thank you for doing this today.
And as we continue to practice social distancing, we'll say that they're both joining us remotely, and thank you for being with us. And just a reminder to our listeners, if you have questions about where to donate or how you can help, you can give us a call at 800-222-9455. Again, 800-222-9455. Molly, let me start with you. Can you talk about some of the different ways that the coronavirus and social distancing measures have affected your food bank and your local partners?
Sure. So, you know, especially during this time, the health and safety of our community volunteers and staff are our top priority. So we're taking extra precautions around our facility to maintain social distancing and other CDC guidelines. Where possible, we're asking staff to work from home, and that's allowed us to shift our workspaces to accommodate more social distancing. We've moved to online meetings, we've increased cleaning and sanitizing, and we've modified our intake processes to minimize direct contact. And then our partner agencies are modifying their food distribution practices to adapt as well. They're moving to a pre-box drive-through service for the most part, and this is to minimize crowding inside buildings and to maintain a 6-foot radius. Some are asking people to come by appointment only, and others are limiting the number of people they can have in their facility at one time.
And I know a lot of us have gone to those grocery stores, we've seen aisles just cleared of food, and some folks have chosen to hoard, although I think a lot of Illinoisans are heeding by the governor's response not to do that. But when you look at canned foods, you know, a lot of them just the shelves being cleared and bread and that sort of thing, how has that affected food banks?
Right. And so I'll just give you one example. In particular, the rural areas are seeing an impact in that regard. We had Atwood Community Food Pantry was here last week to pick up food for their pantry, and they said that their local Dollar General was out of a lot of supplies. And so they were particularly concerned about their older clients and that they those older clients would be facing, you know, having to travel outside of their community to get the supplies they need. So right now, that particular pantry and other pantries in our service area are really critical in, you know, keeping up that community supply chain.
Jim, what have you been hearing from other statewide and national food banks about what they've been dealing with?
Well, since the governor's announcement, we've had daily calls and sometimes multiple calls on a given day. Across the state, all of us are experiencing the same thing, Reginald. We've seen a downturn in the amount of food that's going to be available to us in the short term and maybe the long term, which is going to have a big, big effect. We've also seen that all of our pantries across the state, as Molly indicated, are having to change their practices, as are we. We're going to more box-type foods rather than our normal policies, and our deliveries are going to be a little more difficult with the lack of volunteers at the local food bank. In addition to that, eventually, we're going to have to probably turn to the buying purchased food rather than getting donated food. Let me give you an example of the decrease in donated food. Food flew off the supermarket shelves and store shelves this last week. They get their orders in, it flies off again. What would happen if they had excess food on a daily basis? That would be donated to the food banks across the state. And a great percentage of our food comes from those retail overstock. So we're going to have to change how we do our business on the front end. On the other side is the distribution itself. All of us across the state are experiencing the same things with getting food to pantries, a lack of volunteers at pantries, when those pantries are open. We have three food banks that actually have their warehouses across state lines, and they have difficulty getting in and out of the state with some of their trucks because of different restraints in the states that they have their facilities. So it's been a great unified effort. Nationally, Feeding America has stepped up. We have many, many conference calls, daily contact with Feeding America, our parent organization, on funding not just food resources, but funding resources as well. It's a new paradigm for us, and we're probably going to see these changes now and maybe doing business going forward. But rest assured that we're working on it. It's a challenge. But so far, and I think Molly will agree with that, our friends and neighbors across our areas and across the state have really stepped up to help.
And if I'm hearing you correctly, you know, it's because people aren't just dropping off, you know, maybe boxes or bags of food, maybe the best way may be to give some sort of cash donation maybe to your local food bank so that they can buy the food that they need that they would normally get from the grocery stores.
That's going to be one thing that we are looking heavily at. Yes, Molly can speak to that better than I.
We're talking with Jim Hires and Molly Delaney with the Eastern Illinois Food Bank. Jim, real quickly, how many people does your food bank serve?
Well, Molly probably keeps track on a daily basis of that, and I know her team does, as well as the partnership services, and I think she can address where we are today on that.
Go ahead, Molly.
Sure, and you just mentioned that Feeding America is saying that more than 1.3 million people struggle with food insecurity in the state of Illinois, and that approximately 450,000 of those are children. Locally, we have more than 100,000 people that rely on Eastern Illinois Food Bank for food, and we know that as the pandemic intensifies, that they will be at even greater risk for missing meals. So we know that as jobs are limited or lost, events are canceled, and schools are closed down, those numbers are going to go up. We're not sure yet what the full impact will be, but we know it will go well beyond the immediate pandemic. We did just get some projections from Feeding America this morning that nationally we should be expecting a 9% rise in food insecurity in the next year, and then a 27.8% rise in the number of food insecure individuals in the next 2 years. So we know that this is going to go well beyond this immediate impact.
And Molly, do you expect to receive any sort of federal or state assistance during this time?
And I'm going to let
Jim handle that
one since he's been on.
I keep crossing
you
to it.
That's not a problem at all. We just got some word this last week that Feeding America, the parent organization of the 200 food banks in our association, is working on funding for food banks across the country, those that need emergency funding now and the long term, and have set up ways to do that. And of course, Molly will be directing our fundraising activities in our area. But I think that the need is going to grow. We don't know exactly where it would be. If you ask, are we okay today on Monday the 23rd? I'm okay today. Will I be okay on Monday the 30th? I don't know what that will look like at this point. But we surmise, based on the experience in other areas, that we're going to obviously need additional funding.
And again, as we're hearing, you know, the state of Illinois has been ordered to stay at home. Molly, how did the announcement from Governor Pritzker affect your day-to-day that everyone stay at home?
Sure. So the food bank is actually considered an essential service, and we're exempt from Governor Pritzker's shelter-in-place order, and our partner agencies are also exempt from it. So at this time, we're continuing operations and doing everything we can to prepare to meet the increased needs. With a few exceptions, our network of 170 partner agencies and programs remain open and continue to serve. I think at this point, you know, we're continuing to function. One of the difficult things is that communication and making sure that we are getting all the information out as quickly and as accurately as we can. So we recommend that if people are in need of food and they have a regular pantry or a partner organization of ours that they go to, we want them to call ahead to make sure to confirm the program hours and requirements. In addition to that, we have a list of temporary closures or schedule changes that can be found on our website, and that if you go to our website, which is eifoodbank.org, and then /news, you can find anything that we know about, you'll be able to find there.
Okay. We've been speaking with Molly Delaney. She's Vice President of Development for the Eastern Illinois Food Bank. We also heard from Jim Hyers, who is President and CEO for the Eastern Illinois Food Bank. And Molly and Jim, thank you for taking the time to speak with us, and best of luck with you, to both of you.
Thank you, Reginald.
And we'll have more information up on our website about how to provide assistance if you are interested. You can find us at 21stshow.org. And if you are just tuning in, you're listening to The 21st. We wanted to check in with a few organizations around the state to find out how they are adapting as the coronavirus situation continues to evolve. Animal shelters and humane societies have had to navigate safety concerns while also making sure their animals find great homes. Aaron Buckmaster is shelter director for the Knox County Humane Society in Galesburg, and she joins us on the line now. Hello, Aaron.
Well, hello, and thank you for having us.
So what have the past few weeks been at your shelter?
Well, last Sunday, I got a call from the girl that does our Facebook, and she's also in charge of DD Homes. And she said we would be better off to buckle down right away. And it wasn't this Sunday. It was last Sunday, Sunday before last. So we put a sign on our front door that if people come to our door to call us on our phone, and we would go out to talk to them instead of letting them come into our building. Because a lot of times, you know, with school being out, we felt like people might be dropping off their kids, which they shouldn't, just to have something to do. And we want to keep our employees safe also, because right now I have 5 employees. And if one of them goes down, then we really have an issue in taking care of our animals. So we want to make sure that they stay safe and our animals can be taken care of. But we also are exempt because we do serve the public.
How many animals do you have, and are people still coming in to adopt them?
I think right now people want comfort animals, and they're really interested in helping the shelter. And we have probably we're down a little bit on animals at this time because people have been so proactive. They'll call and say, you know, now is the perfect time to get a pet because we're home. Our kids are home. It's a great time to work with a pet. And it also gives the pet a chance to get out of the shelter and find that new home so it very much needs.
Because of the stay-at-home order, have you had to change, you know, how obviously you want to keep things clean and sanitized, but has that changed at all who can go in and help
Absolutely.
Clean?
Absolutely. Last year, we did an investment. It was 2 years ago. We started investing in improving our building, and it must have been kind of looking to see into the future in a crystal ball, but we decided to put indoor-outdoor pet runs for our dogs where they can go outside, and they surround our whole building. So any of our pets can be seen without even entering our shelter. So they're on indoor-outdoor runs, and that costs us over $100,000 doing all these remodels. And, you know, without the public support, we never would have been able to do all that. We'd saved up our money. Then we also put a catio area where the cats can go outside and be seen. So basically, you can look at all the pets that we have for adoption just by walking around our building, and you can see what's available. And if you're truly want something, give us a call and we'll make an appointment, either come out and show you the pet outside at a safe distance, and then you could also fill out the paperwork out there.
I like that term, catio area.
That's right, and they love it. You know, usually the kids from school come in there, you know, not now, of course, but that's why we had to put a hold on it, because they'll come on the inside area and, you know, play with the cats, and it's a great solution. But this way, they have their own pet doors, so they can go outside and visit the public out there too. So really, it's like an outdoor zoo without having to come in, and it's really helped. Also, we furnish food for a lot of the public. I know the food banks were just talking. We also have a lot of people that depend on us for pet food, and we would hope that people would donate food to us, or, you know, so we can continue to give food to the public, because what they do, we have a sign on the door that says, please do not enter, call this number before, and they call us, and then we will hand them bags of food out the door if they need it.
Okay, that was Erin. So, you know, have to wrap. I'm sorry we ran out of time, but Erin Buckmaster, Shelter Director for the Knox County Humane Society, if you want to help them with monetary donations or dog food donations, sanitation products, go to the21stshow.org. And we will be back with more ways you can help during this coronavirus crisis. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Reginald Hardwick. If you're just tuning in, we've been speaking with Illinois organizations about how they've been impacted by the coronavirus crisis. And as we've been hearing, there are many ways we can help our communities by donating money, resources, or just our support. Healthcare facilities can also use our help. Here's what Dr. John Kreckman had to say. He's Chief Medical Officer at OSF's Heart of Mary Medical Center.
Currently, Heart of Mary has an adequate PPE supply. However, as a proactive measure, OSF Healthcare is accepting donations of any equipment of supplies that can help us deal with the spread of COVID-19. Examples of these supplies would include N95 respirators, surgical masks, face shields, gowns, gloves, ventilators, or any other additional supplies that you think will help.
If you have something you would like to donate to OSF, or if you have questions, you can email support OSF at osfhealthcare.org. I'd like to welcome two more voices here. John Kelker is president of United Way of Central Illinois. I also have John Strimstifer on the line. He's president and CEO of the Community Foundation for the Land of Lincoln. Both of you, welcome to the 21st, and thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
Thanks for having us.
As we continue this conversation, if you have questions about where to donate or how you can help, give us a call at 800-222-9455. Again, 800-222-9455. John Kelker, I want to start with you. United Way has a hotline, 211. What sort of resources can this hotline connect people with during this crisis?
We are keeping our 211 call center up to speed on any operational changes that agencies have. We also, though it's not normal for us, we are keeping 211 informed of what needs in terms of donated items that agencies could have.
And are you seeing a spike in calls right now?
Yes. In fact, they're, I would say, probably tenfold, and it's one of the reasons United Way actually has a staff person at the office each day, because while we want people to call 211, sometimes they don't know about it, and a lot of calls are still coming into my staff, and we're referring them to 211.
Any specific topics people are asking you about or services in particular?
At this point, the lot I'm hearing is about food, making sure some of those families that have either lost their jobs or certainly are staying home need to have food in the home, and those families who perhaps are missing the lunches that their children would have gotten at school.
John Strimstifer, the Land of Lincoln Community Foundation, has set up a special COVID-19 response fund that the community can donate to. Where is that money going?
Well, first of all, thanks, Reginald, for having us on to talk about this. We ignited this fund a little over a week ago with the help of the United Way and really in close collaboration with our health professionals here in Sangamon County to assure that as needs arise, we're on the ready to deploy resources as quickly as possible. As we speak, we're still formulating the process for giving away money. Our organizations traditionally work on a very deliberate pattern of deploying our grants. But now we want to work very quickly. We don't know exactly where the funds will go at this point because we haven't ignited the process yet. But the United Way has done a great job of collecting information from a number of social service areas in the Springfield area to be ready to ignite this grant-making fund, hopefully in the next couple of days.
John Kelker, president of United Way of Central Illinois, let me ask you, what are the counties that your United Way serves?
My United Way here serves Sangamon and Menard County, but the COVID-19 response fund we've agreed will serve Sangamon and the contiguous county. So it will be a larger area than my service area, but it's because so many people come into and rely on Springfield services.
So if you're hearing this all over the state and you're thinking United Way, do you just kind of look up your individual area online or if you want to donate?
Yes, and in fact, many United Ways across the state are activating response funds. And in fact, United Way Worldwide is actually providing assistance for even some of the smallest United Ways to create a means for them, for individuals to support their communities.
So you provide a lot of resources to a lot of different nonprofits. What are the things that you're hearing from them about what they need?
Most of them are traditional items that they need, but they need them in higher quantity now in terms of food for clients that are staying at their offices. And eventually, I think our agencies are going to need financial support to pay their employees who are either working or potentially laid off. So we'll actually be looking at some of the things the federal government's looking at in terms of how do we maintain the nonprofit sector in terms of keeping people employed or reemploying them as soon as we can.
John Strimstifer, tell me a little bit more about the Land of Lincoln Community Foundation. Where do you serve, or you know, what counties do you serve, and traditionally, what have you all done?
Yeah, we serve, as John stated, really, we always serve the kind of the capital region, so it's Sangamon and adjacent counties. So those would include Logan, Menard, Cass, Morgan, Montgomery, Macoupin, and Christian, in addition to Sangamon. But community foundations, much like United Ways, cover almost every corner of Illinois. We are philanthropic organizations that give money away on an ongoing basis. And I have heard through our own statewide network, the Alliance of Illinois Community Foundations, some discussions and how we all kind of join hands here and work throughout Illinois from top to bottom. And I hope that we'll have some more organizations statewide for how philanthropy can play an important role in this, as hopefully later this week.
I know you're still putting together the distribution model and everything. Do you see just a kind of trust that people apply for or different organizations? How do you foresee that going forward?
Yeah, we really see this as a proactive fund because we are in such close communication with our local agencies and the health professionals. And so we believe that we'll be able to deploy some resources here, as I said, in the next couple of days. I think that's where having these local contacts through local United Ways, local community foundations, people who know the trusted organizations that need to be supported at this time of crisis. And so we can act very quickly on this. I'm not too concerned about getting the money out there because I know there are emerging needs that we're seeing on nearly an hour-to-hour basis.
John Kelker with United Way of Central Illinois. And again, I'm saying John, your last names, because we have two
guys
named John on the line. So let me ask you, how can the public safely help? And how can they help if they haven't maybe already, you know, portioned their incomes to United Way or whatever? How can they help?
One of the easiest ways, we have set up a texting opportunity. People can text the word HELP now to 40403, and those funds are specifically for the COVID response fund.
Okay, repeat that. HELP now to which number?
40403.
Okay. And John Strumsever?
Well, I was going to say they could also make their gifts directly to United Way or to the foundation.
Sorry about cutting you off. John Strunstever.
Yeah, both websites have online giving portals. People also can send in checks to our addresses. And I would suggest for your statewide listeners, they do the same in their own local communities and seek out their United Ways and community foundations. As, again, we are, you know, longstanding institutions in our communities that are place-based in our own local communities throughout Illinois. So I think they're trusted places to go for people who are just, you know, really compelled to do something right now. I think it's especially unique with this crisis that our elected officials, our public health officials are saying, stay away from one another, which is, I think, against our basic human instincts. So this is a way that people can do something good, I hope, without having to leave their home.
John Strumsever is president and CEO of the Community Foundation for the Land of Lincoln. We also heard from John Kelker. He is president of United Way of Central Illinois, and he says you can text HELP now to 40403 to continue bringing in donations to help those of our neighbors who are in need during this crisis. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've also talked about we're also talking about ways we can give back. We also wanted to talk about why giving back can benefit us, too. Alexandra Solomon is a clinical assistant professor and licensed clinical psychologist at the Family Institute at Northwestern University. Alexandra, welcome to the 21st. Thank you for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
There are many different aspects of this situation that can be challenging for us mentally. What have you been hearing from your clients about what they're dealing with?
Absolutely, you are right. There's really no domain of our human lives that is left untouched by this time. It's affecting us economically and physically and relationally and emotionally and pragmatically. So it's really hitting us on all fronts. So what I'm seeing, I'm hearing about a lot of disruption, obviously, with parents and kids, and it's really challenging for parents who are home with kids of any age, really, because kids' emotions are strong, you know, and as our parents, and oftentimes when our kids are suffering, we as parents can at least keep our noses a bit above the waterline because we're not being, you know, affected by whatever our kids are upset about in quite the same way that we are. But man, this is one that's just getting us all. And so there's a lot of responsibility on parents to stay calm, cool, and collected. And I'm hearing about a lot of financial fears and then a lot of just the challenges of being together, you know, around the clock.
We've been hearing about some different ways that we can help local organizations throughout the day here. How can doing good for others help us feel better?
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that really stands out in the research is that after a community or a culture or society goes through something really horrific and frightening, one of the long-term traumatic aspects can be something that the field of psychology has called moral injury. And moral injury is when we look back at how we behaved during the horrible time and we feel kind of ashamed about ways in which we were selfish or didn't look out for each other. So what we're doing right now with the people you just had on a moment ago who are talking about here's how you can give and here's how you can support, in some ways it's helping those who are offering support as much as those who are receiving support. Because when we offer support, when we look out for our neighbors, we're basically inoculating ourselves against down the road feeling like we've committed some kind of a moral injury, some way in which we were behaving in ways that were selfish and small-minded. And so looking out for others is kind of a way of taking care of ourselves and remembering our basic humanity.
I know people love to volunteer. I love to volunteer. And you know, when you're at a food bank and you're putting, you know, food in the bags and handing it to someone or seeing a family take it away, mm-hmm. you know, that really appreciates it. When you're social distancing, you can't really do that, or you can't see the family that you're helping provide money for cleaning supplies or whatever. I mean, is that a challenge?
Absolutely. We don't get that immediate feedback loop, do we, that is about, as you're saying, the smile on somebody's face or really feeling we've gotten our hands in there and we've been connected on a sort of supply chain or working with other volunteers. We lose out on all of that. But I guess I would just invite us to remember that even though it's a bit more abstract, we are still doing good, right? The good, the end result is still there, even if the process isn't quite as fun. And so we can sort of mourn the loss of the process, but keep our eye on the prize here, which is that we're doing good and we're helping out.
You know, a lot of people, you know, this is possibly taking a financial toll on them, and maybe they don't have a lot of money to donate. What are some ways that people can help that aren't connected to money?
I think that's a great question, because that is, it's a legitimate fear, and people are quite quickly ending up in financial hardship. And so I really respect that, and I want us all to be mindful of that as well. And one simple one that I was just reading about this morning is calling a local nursing home and finding out if they would accept, snail mail, just a letter or a little note to residents. And so that might be one way of feeling like it's free or it's very low cost, but it's still able to just put a smile on somebody's face. Another option might be to check in with neighbors and offer to do some grocery shopping for neighbors who are older or who are more in a vulnerable population. So there again, we aren't spending our own money, but we're offering to do something to kind of take care of somebody in a way that is just kind of, you know, neighborly and connected.
We're talking with Alexandra Solomon, clinical assistant professor and with the Department of Psychology at Northwestern University. I saw the hashtag Alone Together trending this weekend. There are a lot of other hashtags, you know, tends to rise up during isolation. How does social media play a role in kind of bringing out a collective camaraderie?
Boy, for as much time as we spend talking about the worries and the sort of shadowy aspects of social media, right now I feel like we're seeing a lot of the beauty of social media, right? There's just been some playful memes, I think, that can keep people's spirits up. We know that laughter, even if it's sort of what we call that gallows humor, even some of that at a time like this can just help us feel a bit less alone. And those hashtags, as you're saying, just help us feel connected. And part of one of the ways that we can feel like we suffer a bit less is to remember that we aren't alone in our suffering and that we aren't the only one who's feeling afraid or who's feeling sad. And so even if we are physically alone, we're emotionally connected. And that is, social media is maybe a micro dose of connection, but I also really want to encourage people to be getting on the phone, getting on Skype, getting on video chat, because looking at the face of somebody who matters tremendously to you counts a heck of a lot more than a little hashtag. You know, we can appreciate those little hashtags, but they don't add up to quite as much as a heartfelt conversation with somebody that you are separated from, who knows your history, who shares your heart and where you're going to be building a future together once this is all over. So I really want people to be checking in on their community, on their crew, and making sure that that they're allowing for just lots of time for socializing.
About 30 seconds left. Any other advice for ways to help and how it helps us in return?
I think that, we can't pour from an empty cup. So I really want people to also be caring for themselves, making sure they're getting a little bit of movement each day, making healthy food choices, getting enough sleep, but not too much sleep, so that they are strong and sturdy and then able to have that bandwidth to be looking always for ways they can be of service to others.
Alexandra Solomon is a clinical assistant professor and licensed clinical psychologist at the Family Institute at Northwestern University. Alexandra, thank you for taking some time to speak with us today.
Thanks so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Stay tuned to your local NPR station this week as we continue to bring you the latest on the coronavirus. Tomorrow on the 21st, we'll be talking more about how local businesses and the food industry have been impacted by COVID-19 and the stay-at-home order. I'm Reginald Hardwick. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Reginald Hardwick. With the stay-at-home order issued in Illinois this weekend, many of us will be using that extra time indoors to catch up on reading, podcasts, and maybe some TV. We thought now would be the perfect opportunity to revisit an interview the 21st did back in January with Theo Germain, an Illinois native who plays James in the Golden Globe-nominated Netflix series The Politician. And they also play the character of Chris in Work in Progress, a Showtime comedy set in Chicago. Theo identifies as gender non-binary, and Lee Gaines spoke with them about their take on LGBTQ representation in Hollywood and going from working in a Chicago coffee shop to having a role on a major Netflix series. But Lee started by asking them about their experience growing up in Central Illinois.
Theo, I understand you're an Illinois native. Can you tell me a little bit about where you grew up?
Yeah, I was born in Murfreesboro, which is a super, super tiny little town right by Carbondale down in southern Illinois. And I grew up mostly right around the Champaign-Urbana area in a small town called Monticello. But I went to college. I went to Parkland and I went to U of I. So I lived in Champaign-Urbana for like 5 or 6 years, I think, before transferring or transitioning to Chicago.
Wow. So you're pretty familiar with the area then.
Oh, yes. Very familiar.
With what we like to call Central Illinois, but perhaps what some in Chicago might just refer to as downstate blanket statement.
Right. Right. Or they'd say Southern Illinois, and I'm like, no. That's not true. Yeah.
So you moved to Chicago, and you began acting in some productions there. Can you tell me a little bit about what you were doing after you graduated from the U of I?
So I studied acting when I was in college. I was kind of like, when it was getting to that time where it was like, am I going to go to school or not? I was like, yes. And I was like, I don't know if I can study anything else besides acting, and I want to try to pass college. So I graduated and spent a couple of months in Champaign-Urbana kind of like finishing business up and, you know, getting ready to move to Chicago. There were a lot of people who were saying, you should go to New York, you should go to Los Angeles. And I thought, no, those places are too big. Chicago seems like the right kind of size for me to start getting used to living in the city. So I started working on a couple of indie film projects while I was in transition to moving to Chicago. And then when I got there, I kind of just started auditioning for things. I luckily got a talent agent right out of school and just started getting cast in plays. And that was kind of my life for about 2.5 years. So the Politician audition was just something that I received as a breakdown, as an email, which is something I was very used to. And I got an offer about 3.5 days after auditioning for it. So
wow,
everything happened very, very quickly. It was like I was in Chicago, I was doing plays, I was doing all this stuff, I was wanting to do more, I wasn't getting the opportunity to do so yet, and then all of a sudden it was like, all right, it's happening right now, and your life is going to change really quickly right now.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow. So your life changed in a major way. And I want to talk about the role that changed your life. So you play the role of James in The Politician, which premiered in the fall. And the show is kind of this quirky, dramatic, funny series. It has kind of a Wes Anderson vibe to it also. Mm-hmm. And it follows a high school election in California. And you play the right-hand man campaign manager for Peyton, who all of his life has wanted to be president of the United States, mm-hmm. and he views this high school election as part of his rise to power, and he seems very willing to win at all costs.
Yeah.
Well, we actually have a clip here from The Politician, and mm-hmm. this is James meeting after the high school debate with Peyton, who again is running for high school president, and Peyton is played by Ben Platt. And McAfee, the other campaign manager, played by Laura Dreyfus, are strategizing in the library.
People lie, numbers don't. River's ahead of you 10 points post-debate.
And if you dig down into the tabs of the polls, he's leading you in looks, charisma, and most importantly, authenticity.
He's basically crushing you in that department, especially after that masterclass he put on during the debate. Girls love when a guy who looks like that cries, not blubbery at all, more of a silent, sexy cry.
Oh, okay, fine. Well, why don't all of you just go and vote for him then?
Our loyalty is with you, Peyton. This is a plane. We're all headed to the same place. You're the pilot, James and I are your navigators.
Neither one of us knows how to fly like you can. We need you to get us to the White House, but we wouldn't be doing our job if we weren't being honest with you. If we don't tell it like it is, we'll all crash.
I just have to say I love this show. It's so funny. It's so like Wes Anderson meets the West Wing. And I think what makes it so funny is this very serious conversation is actually happening in the context of a high school.
Yeah.
So yeah. Would you say that James was your first big role?
On TV, yes. Yeah. Yeah, the first time I really had the opportunity to do something like this.
Yeah, I wonder what was going through your head the moment that you realized you had been cast.
I was totally freaking out. I was at work that day. It was a Monday. I got called by my agents as I was clocking out of work on a Monday afternoon. And
where were you working? I'm just curious.
Oh, I was working at this coffee shop in Chicago called Wormhole.
Oh, I know Wormhole. Yes.
I love everybody. It's so much fun there. I love the people that work there so much. It's my favorite place.
It was one of my favorite places
to work.
And for our listeners who might not know where that is, it's in Wicker Park in Chicago. It's a pretty great place to grab a coffee. So you were leaving Wormhole when you found out that you had been cast in this major Netflix series.
Yeah, and all of my coworkers, I had told them the previous week, I was like, I had this really good audition and something might happen from it. And so I got this phone call and I was sitting at the counter after I'd clocked out and everybody behind the counter was like, what's going on? And then I started freaking out and everyone was like, did that thing happen? And I was like, it happened.
That's
amazing. And
everyone
was like, yeah. And then I screamed a whole bunch and I on my phone, I ran outside and was kind of running around on the sidewalk and screaming. And all the people who were getting coffee at the coffee shop were looking out at me like, what is this lunatic doing running around on the phone screaming? And then it started to rain outside. And so the storm happened in the middle of the sunlight shining down. I calmed down and I asked my agents what's next. And they said, well, you're going to move to Los Angeles in 3 days.
Oh, my God.
And I said, okay. And I was totally freaking out, but I tried to not show that.
One thing I'm also curious about, Theo, is, you know, the politician, one of the things that I think is so interesting about this show and so great about this show is that the sexuality of each of the characters is never really a plot point. Most of them have queer relationships, but it's not really, you know, discussed or a huge part of the storyline. And the same goes for your character, James, because I understand that they cast this role as trans masculine. And so I'm curious, was that the intention on the part of the show's writers?
Yeah, I think that they very deliberately wrote a breakdown that said we wanted to cast a trans person in this role.
And so what was your reaction to that, you know, once you got more familiar with the script that, you know, we were going to see a lot of queer characters in this show, but discussing queerness as a big deal or as something, you know, non-normative wasn't going to really be a part of the show?
It's new territory, I feel like, where you're not really doing a show that's like, this is all about queer things, but everybody is fluid in some sort of sense. It's new territory and it's kind of exciting. I'm like, wow, can more TV shows kind of just like have gay people and not make a big deal about it? Make it more about the gay characters being a nurse or a teacher instead of them being gay, because it's not a personality trait.
Yeah. No, it was one of the things that I really enjoyed about the show personally. And I'm also curious, what feedback have you gotten from it?
I've gotten a lot of positive feedback. I'm on social media, and so I like read the responses to the show and things like that. I get a lot of like DM requests on my social media feeds about people being really excited that they've seen someone like me in a show and just have it not be a big deal and just have me be a high school student.
But I also want to mention that you recently got another role in a comedy on Showtime called Work in Progress, which stars...
Yes,
and that stars Abby McEnany?
Yes, Abby McEnany.
Who also created the series, and she plays an anxious, queer, middle-aged woman in Chicago who thinks she killed her therapist. And you play Chris in the show, a trans man who works as a waiter and starts dating Abby. What was it like auditioning for that role?
So I actually auditioned for that before The Politician was even in my life, because by luck, by opportunity, this episode, which aired on TV in its original form, got picked up by Showtime from Sundance and then went straight to series, and now has been renewed for a second season. So Work in Progress is actually the first thing in my life.
Wow. And I'm curious what you in particular appreciated about that opportunity, getting to work on this show, which again is centering the experience of a queer woman and also her relationship with your character.
I was really excited about the type of queer story that this was going to be. At first, I only had the pilot because the rest of the show didn't exist yet. I was excited because we're seeing a queer middle-aged self-identified dyke, which is someone that we don't see on TV ever. We only see skinny people. We only see very particular type of queer people, very particular type of lesbians. And so I was like, yes, amazing. Midwestern dykes, I'm so excited about this. And then when I read the pilot script, there's this scene that happens between the two of them in which Chris asks Abby out on a date and she mistakes him for a baby dyke. And when he corrects her, she's like, oh my gosh, I've never been on a date with a trans man before. Let's do this. And so the show approaches everything with acceptance and also approaches things with, I might not know what's going on, but I'm going to learn.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it felt exciting to be able to play a character who's also trans, who talks about it as part of the storyline, but it's just more about their romantic relationship and navigating their relationship as two queer people who are from different generations, but who have found each other in a way that they both probably really need right now.
It really strikes me as you're talking, Theo, that, you know, the two major television roles that you've had have been really interesting and unique opportunities in television. They've been opportunities to tell stories that, as you've said, aren't, you know, frequently represented on the small screen. How do you feel about that?
I feel a little intimidated because a lot of it feels like it's new territory, and there's a lot that I am navigating in the industry as I learn more about myself and as I learn more about how to fight for opportunities that I want. It feels like a dream come true. I also hope that the opportunities that I am having will help writers who see it be like, oh, we should have more people like this, you know, in shows. I hope that it's moving the needle a little bit. But there are so many people who are working to do that. And I'm so grateful for all these other trans actors who are in the industry. I don't know, it feels exciting and new and scary and has inspired me to do a whole bunch of things that I don't think I would ever have the courage to do, which is I'm writing my own content now. I'm starting to create my own content. I'm working on a short film in a couple of months that I've written. And it's just made me feel a lot more confident than I ever really have before.
Those are really beautiful reflections. I really appreciate that, Theo. I'm also just curious, you know, are you going to continue to make Illinois your home or a home base of sorts? Do you imagine coming back here on a regular basis, or do you think, you know, you're living that LA life now?
I am calling from Chicago, actually. Chicago is still my main home. I'm choosing to make it my main home. If that ever has to change, it will, but staying in Illinois is pretty important to me, and so I want to try to continue to work on the coasts and then come back here and make a lot of content and get my friends jobs. So yeah, I'm calling from Illinois.
That's great, Theo. Thank you so much. We've been speaking with Theo Germain. They're an actor based in Chicago, and they have roles both on The Politician, a Netflix series, and Work in Progress, which is a series on Showtime. Thank you so much, Theo, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Lee Gaines speaking with actor and Central Illinois native Theo Germain back in January. Theo plays James in the Netflix series The Politician and plays Chris in the Showtime comedy Work in Progress. That's it for us today. Listen to these segments again at 21stshow.org or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Reginald Hardwick. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thank you for listening.